From UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation, this is Tales from the South. Recorded in front of a live audience every Tuesday night during dinner at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Sit back, relax, and let's reconnect with the power of a story.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Audrey Dean Kelly? You can find Audrey Dean Kelly's self-titled debut album on iTunes, and more can be heard at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a very special edition of Tales from the South, our seventh annual holiday show, where Southerners bring their own true holiday stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark can be heard on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues, and Blues at Daybreak, and was the featured house guitarist for the late bluesman Junior Kimbrough's juke joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? On tonight's holiday show, our writers all take us back to some of their Christmas memories as they remind us of some of our own. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Wetzel LeGrone gets a Christmas gift he'll always remember. Ann Tallman's gift is better than she could have dreamt. Sandra Spots Hamilton's Christmas arrives months after December. Mary Elaine Lester tries to make it through another holiday and ends up with a miracle. And Martin Ferguson goes on a wild goose chase on Christmas Eve. But let's start the night with Sarah Etchen Baker as a sacrifice makes a certain Christmas unforgettable in He'd Walk a Mile for a Camel.
Late Christmas Eve afternoon, my father pulled into the driveway, loudly honking the horn on his truck. My brother looked out the window. It's Daddy, and he's got a Christmas tree tied to the back of his pickup truck. You need to come, he said excitedly. It was 1960, and recession had struck that year. The amount of work my father had was substantially reduced. Household expenses had mounted as we approached Thanksgiving and the holiday season. And during that time, I overheard one of my parents' quiet conversations about money. I just don't know how we'll afford Christmas this year, my mother cried. I've scrimped and saved as much as I could. I just don't know what we'll do. You needn't worry yourself about Christmas, my father assured her. We'll have enough for Christmas. Just wait and see. "But how?" my mother whimpered. "Just wait and see. Wait and see," was all he kept saying. So Thanksgiving passed, and we entered the month of December. Respectfully, my brothers and I spoke little about Christmas presents in the holidays, for we knew that times were tough at our house. I recall, though, that throughout December, my father cheerfully whistled Christmas tunes around the house, seemingly unaware that we had no Christmas tree and certainly no presents. Aww. And then came Christmas Eve, and the truck, and the tree. We all flung open the door and scurried outside screaming, "It's a Christmas tree, a real Christmas tree." My father threw the tree across his back, and we danced around him as he carried it inside. While we decorated the tree, the afternoon slipped away. Soon twilight fell, and the pale winter stars slid into their places. I sat on the couch, looked out the window, and watched the sky as it turned to a light, dusky purple littered with hundreds of twinkling stars. Soon, the wind slowly shifted to the north and the sky darkened. Snow, soft as sleep, began falling. Inside our warm house, I breathed in the delicious, heartwarming aroma of Christmas. That fragrant pine of the evergreen branches, now adorned with bright, shiny glass ornaments, shimmering lights, and sparkling icicles. After Christmas Eve dinner, my father returned to his easy chair, and I climbed onto his lap, begging, "Oh, Daddy, blow me some smoke rings. Please, Daddy, please." My father always relaxed in his easy chair after dinner with a burning cigarette in his left hand and a cup of coffee in his right. I frequently climbed onto his lap, shared his coffee, and eagerly awaited for him to blow smoke rings. Like so many men of his generation, he had been smoking since his early teens. His father was also a smoker, so learning to smoke was a given, a sort of rite of passage. So as he drove to work every Monday morning, he stopped at the local convenience store and purchased his weekly supply of cigarettes, a carton of Camel Straights. Even now, I can picture the unique Camel package, a single dromedary camel standing on desert sand with pyramids and palm trees in the background. My father was such a loyal Camel smoker that I often heard him echo the Camel slogan, "I'd walk a mile for a Camel." He simply believed the Camel advertisement that stated, "You can't buy a cigarette more delightful than Camels at any price." Even his favorite Hollywood actor, John Wayne, endorsed Camels. "The roles I play in movies are far from easy on my voice. I can't risk throat irritation, so I smoke Camels. They are mild." Sign of the times. In our nightly ritual, he'd pull out a pack of cigarettes from his shirt pocket, gently tapping until a single cigarette popped up. He'd carefully place the cigarette between his index and middle fingers and slowly bring it to his mouth. Then, like a magician, he'd flip open his cigarette lighter and bring the flame close to the tip of the cigarette. And in one puff, the cigarette was fully lit. He'd wave the lit cigarette like a fiery magic wand in front of my face, exclaiming, "Abracadabra!" Then he'd oblige me, blowing countless smoke rings towards the living room ceiling while I giggled. The magical smoke rings eventually faded once he put out his cigarettes. That Christmas Eve, I could hardly contain myself as I waited for the smoke rings to begin. "You know," my father said as he patted his shirt pocket, "I think I left my cigarettes behind the seat of my truck." He thought for a moment, rubbed his chin, and said, "I'll blow you some smoke rings if you'll go outside and get my cigarettes." And with that, I grabbed my jacket and stepped outside. Dark frost was in the air and it nipped at my nose, my warm breath mingling with the crisp, cold air as it stung my cheeks. The chilling winter winds whistled, blowing, swirling, and spinning the snow in all directions, making me feel as if I was walking in a snow globe. Through the blinding snow, I found the door handle on the truck and yanked on it, its cold, rusty hinges groaning like an old man. I opened the door and pulled back the seat, and there, as if in a dream, were four carefully wrapped Christmas gifts with our names on them. I scooped them up into my arms and charged back into the house. "Well, look what you found in my truck," he exclaimed. "I saw Santa Claus on the way home, and he gave me your gifts. Merry Christmas." So later that night, after the house went to bed, I sat up in my own bed, listening to my parents talking in the room adjacent to mine. How, my mother asked, "were you able to buy a Christmas tree and all those presents?" "I told you to just wait and see," he explained. "So for 3 months, I've taken the money I would have spent on my camels and tossed it in a coffee can under the seat of my truck. This morning, I took that money and bought the tree and gifts. I quit smoking, so you and the children would have Christmas." The house became quiet, so I snuggled down into my warm covers and looked out the frosty window, at the snow dancing around my father's truck. And just before I fell asleep, I said, "I'm so sorry." I said a silent prayer for my father. Thank you.
Sarah Etchen Baker is a retired educator living in Texas who enjoys writing personal narratives and memoirs, many of which have been published in anthologies and magazines. She's a regular contributor at Tiny Lights and is currently working on her first novel entitled Dillehaye Crossing. In our next story, Wetzel Legrone's memory of a Christmas present over 70 years ago has not faded in My Red Wagon.
I might have been the happiest six-year-old in the world. Well, at least in Deadwood, Texas, that Christmas morning in 1940, when I awoke and found Santa had brought me a new red wagon. Rural East Texas was still in the grips of the Depression, but Santa Claus always brought us a toy and a special treat of fruit, nuts, and hard candy. But the red wagon was something special. This was a Christmas to remember, where that red wagon became a toy and a work vehicle for years. I'm the oldest of seven children, but at the time I only had a younger sister and brother. I have a photograph made that Christmas, posed by the gate, by the picket fence in our front yard. I was standing in front of the wagon. My little sister was standing at the rear of the wagon holding a doll that Santa had brought her, and my little brother was sitting in the wagon. We lived in an old house that had wood shutters that opened and closed instead of glass windows. We slept under mosquito nets. Of course, there was no electricity or indoor plumbing. The chimney of the fireplace was made from dried blue gumbo mud and grass mix. Remember how bricks were made in the Bible? The house was located by an old wagon road that was seldom used by automobile traffic. We were about a quarter mile south of my paternal grandparents. I'm sure that our economic condition bothered our parents, but us kids were oblivious to the situation. No one we knew was much better off. Dad drove a log truck, and in that era in 1940, he was lucky to have a job. Now, back to the red wagon. Just east of the house by the old road was an old sawdust pile. One morning, a few days after Christmas, when I was out playing, I saw tracks in the edge of the sawdust that could have only been made by my wagon. Since I hadn't had the wagon in that area, I asked Dad about the tracks. He told me that Santa must have been towing the wagon behind his sleigh. At 6 years old, that was good enough for me. I never asked about it again. Now, in later years, I suspect that wagon must have been hid at my grandparents' house, and he'd gone and brought it home after we were asleep. Now, the summer I turned 7, we moved to a house on the main gravel road to Deadwood. The house belonged to my great-aunt Lucy Carrington, my grandfather's grown sister. She was a widow, and all of her kids had been married and gone, and she had built a small modern house across the road. This house had glass windows, still no electricity or plumbing. Now, one thing I remember when we lived in that house was the peach trees, where Mother and Daddy got switches to administer what they call peach tree tea across my rear. Now, I'm sure I never deserved a switching. Just to prove that point, Santa thought I was a good boy, because that Christmas he brought me a single-shot BB gun. There was a country store about a quarter mile up the hill north of us. Sometimes Mother would send me to the grocery store with a list. Nowadays, can you imagine a 7-year-old walking to the store owner filling the order and charging it? By this time, my second brother had arrived, and we walked to visit my grandparents or anywhere else. The baby and my first brother rode in the red wagon. If we went down the main road to the lane that went to my grandpa's house, we were like walking two sides of a right triangle. So we cut across the shortest route, across the pasture to take the old wagon road that ran in front of their house. The summer I was 8, my dad got a job with United Gas Pipeline Company. He worked for them until he retired. We moved about 15 miles to the community of Latex. The gas company had built a compressor station and gasoline plant in the middle of nowhere, and built houses for their employees. I thought we had moved uptown. We had running water. We had an indoor toilet. We had gas heaters. We had DC electricity from the generators that ran the compressor station. Now, the company also had an ice-making facility for their various units and the employees. Now, my red wagon went to work again. My parents bought an ice box. When more ice was needed, I was sent to the company ice house with my red wagon to get it. We also were allotted a spot about a quarter mile from the house for a garden, and the wagon was called in to play again to haul produce from the garden. I've had many good Christmases in my life. I've gotten things I wanted, things I needed. I still have the set of 8 Tarzan books that Santa brought when I was 10. But down that chilly Christmas morning in 1940, when Santa Claus was still real and magical, when I ran my hand along the side of that red wagon, somehow I knew the present would stand out like no other. And after 72 years, it still does.
Working with the young and old, Wetzel Lagrone is his Kiwanis Club's liaison with the Dover High School Key Club and is on the board of directors of his area agency on aging. Next, Ann Tallman wakes up Christmas morning to the best gift, one that does not have to be wrapped, in Christmas 1963.
My eyes were closed, toes wiggling. At our house, Santa left a wrapped gift at the foot of each of our beds to open upstairs before we went to the downstairs family room for the rest. We called it the wake-up gift. Mother was making coffee in the percolator for Dad. The sound of that percolator was as comforting as the dishwasher the night before, both of which I imitated. Mom, watch! It goes brump! And clicks while it perks, and then just before it's ready, makes a ton of noise all together with a hiss, which I would then perform. Woods, coffee's ready. Mercy, come quick. Ann's doing the percolator again. Dad had a friend in the mines who always ate dessert first from his lunch bucket in case of a cave-in. Not me. I drag things out. I was saving my wake-up gift, wondering what it might be. Maybe it's a Thumbelina that wriggles, or Skipper, or a Pokey to go with my Gumby, or a chatty Kathy that talks just like Caroline Kennedy's. It could be the blonde, or the brown, or the red-haired one. I wouldn't care, Santa, honest. I adored Caroline Kennedy, but especially now her daddy went up to God in heaven too soon. I told my dad during prayers the night of the assassination just 1 month before. I had added nightly God blesses for her and John John. Dad said that Caroline and I were growing up together separately. Hey, Woody, can you see your wake-up gift? I shouted through our bedroom wall. Me too. Martha, I hear squirrels in the house, Dad said from the kitchen. Woody is my big brother, a baby boomer, cerebral palsied from birth in 1948. And though he's nonverbal and in a wheelchair, that has never prevented his wit, sweet essence, and elfishness from brightly shining through. He was home for the holidays from his special sleepaway school in Birmingham, I called it. I adored my big brother and still do. Most kids opened those glittery little doors on their December Advent calendars to count down to Christmas morning. I used mine, scotch taped to my bedroom door, to count the days until Woody was home, and our family was complete like I wished it could always be. I was so excited, I didn't know whether to open my gift right there or run and jump into bed with Woody. So I grabbed it and took it with me to his room. Mother and Dad, still in their pajamas, soon joined. I was so happy, I was jumping up and down and thrilled that nobody told me not to. Dad took Woody's maple bedsides down, brought all the pillows to the head of the bed, and pulled Woody up in his arms to prop him against them so that he could see everything going on.
Brother is holding court over the proceedings, y'all.
Dad smiled his Kris Kringle grin. We all had puppy breath. It was far too exciting for anyone to take time to brush their teeth. We got on the bed surrounding Woody. He got to open his gift first. When Woody opened gifts, I helped guide his hand with the tape or ribbon to get it started, but the mad arm let me know if I helped too much when it was something that he could then manage.
Just because brother has CP doesn't mean he can't do things, Miss Ann,
Dad reminded me.
Right, son?
He drooled when he concentrated and it got on the wrapping. Woody, be careful, you'll melt the ribbon. He replied, drooling more because I had distracted him. Dad lovingly wiped Woody's lips with one of the linen hankies he always kept in his plaid flannel robe, and Mother spread Vaseline on them from the jar she kept on the maple dresser next to his Hopalong Cassidy wristwatch. I couldn't wait. I had to rip the paper away, and for a second I thought he was going to get angry. Instead, he rolled his eyes, and everyone broke out laughing. Look, it's a train for your Lionel, Woody. It's a big red caboose like the ones in Gary. Kids from all over the neighborhood came to see Woody Tallman's train collection at Christmas. My parents knew that it was important for Woody to have toys that he could participate in, and they were creative in finding, inventing, or adapting toys for him in the 50s. Electrical or battery operated with simple hand controls and long cords were ideal, and we duct taped, as I called it, the controls on his wheelchair tray attachment. This was before we had what Mother called the greatest invention of the 20th century, Velcro.
Y'all know what I call a caboose, don't you?
Dad asked, as Woody stared at his new train and cooed like the twin pigeon doves who lived on the ledge outside our bedroom windows. Here we go, Mother smiled.
I call the caboose the shank of the train. Oh, Woods, go on. That is rich.
My gift was a Kodak Instamatic 104 to go with Mother's brownie. I still see her holding her brownie at her waist and looking down through the window to line it up and attempting to press the button fast enough. I was so hyper, they called me Squirrel. And there are countless blurred photos because the shutter speed couldn't catch me. On my new camera, the flash bulb snapped on top, so she showed me how to lick the bottom first before popping them in. We loaded the film and I took pictures all day. Mother got her favorite perfume, Chantilly, in its pretty pink bottle with the lacy box, and she sprayed us both. Dad got a box of cigars that he would soon smoke when we went downstairs to build the fire to get cuddly for more gifts. Does anyone want breakfast first? How about some cinnamon toast real quick? No, let's go, I shouted while Woody did what I named the monkey howl. We bundled him in blankets, his Davy Crockett coonskin cap, and mittens. It's impossible to get each of his fingers into gloves. Dad wheeled Woody down to the family room on the concrete ramp around the side of the house. Mr. Cortez, our contractor, had surprised my parents with it when he saw Woody in his wheelchair as he was finishing our house in 1959. While Dad brought Woody, Mother and I went downstairs to turn on the space heater. My eyes were darting everywhere. She knew I could barely wait to see what Santa brought. Our Santa didn't wrap the rest of his gifts. He left them scattered around the rumpus room. Each year, Dad announced, "Well, y'all, I'm gonna get what I need, whether I want it or not," as he opened his last tie box from under the tree. There was so much to look forward to. Gifts, pancakes with warm cinnamon syrup, salty Smithfield Virginia ham, Christmas calls, surprise drop-bys, and Mother's famous whiskey eggnog. Though a teetotaler herself, she honestly got tippy from the fumes of the booze as she mixed it each year in a huge plastic bowl. After gifts, we played with Woody's trains and race cars, and soon there would be football on the Philco, stinky cigar smoke, Dad blowing smoke rings, with his feet propped on his favorite camel saddle footstool, and then home movies. We watched them on our makeshift screen, the shiny white side of the washing machine. In the afternoon, we went sledding with Woody on his special sled, which Dad made with a wooden back to hold him up, and he equipped it with an airplane seat belt. Everything, I never wanted to end, I thought. Ian, I declare you are walking drunk. Did you sneak some of Daddy's eggnog? Woods, have you ever seen her so silly?
Can't say that I have, Martha.
I can't help it, you guys. Woody's home. It's the best day of my whole life so far. Eee! Howled Woody, to which I squealed, wee-wee!
Originally from the South, Ann Tolman is a New York City-based actress, having worked on Broadway, off-Broadway, regionally, in TV, film, and commercials. She's a storyteller developing a show from her collection, Woody and Me and the Kindness of Strange People. In our next story, Sandra spots Hamilton struggles with a difficult holiday, only to have the best gift arrive months later in Screaming Red Toenails.
It was only December 15th, and all my shopping was done, all the presents were wrapped, and holiday baked goods were waiting in the freezer. All I had to do was lie back and rest in the hospital bed. I surveyed the room full of flowers and thanked myself for having the forethought to get ready for Christmas ahead of this surgery, and at the same time gently chastised myself for being so glib. I'd fallen right into the usual cancer patient mode of thinking, that only happens to other people, and surely not me, a 35-year-old wife, mom, and teacher. Those things just don't happen. They'll wake me and tell me it was just a cyst or something. Well, they didn't. Instead, they woke me and they told me it was a 2-centimeter tumor in my breast with tumors in half my lymph nodes. Merry Christmas to me. My eyes fell on the one floral arrangement that symbolized the reaction I had received from friends and family. Breast cancer in a young woman, especially in those days, usually caused friends and family to react in one of two ways. Either they cut and run, or they sent a floral arrangement big enough to be entered as a float in the Rose Parade. This floral had to have left all the Hawaiian islands completely stripped of vegetation. The number of poinsettias in the room seemed to express special feelings of regret that this terrible thing had happened during this season of joy. The saving grace is the precious handful of friends who stick by you. My friend Judy, who is a pastor with the face and spirit of an angel, visited and in 3 minutes said enough to help me reconcile the joy of Christmas with the grief of cancer. After that, I kept the vision of these two specters holding hands. The ghost of ghastly cancer helped me to more deeply greet the spirit of Christmas joy. Our Christmas that year was a curious mix of mood, joyous and somber all at once, with lots of forced smiles and awkward hugs. Sister and family had traveled through an ice storm to be with me. Every scripture reading and a service was loaded with additional meaning, and every Christmas card, even the corny ones, caused a couple of tears. But thank God for the small tasks of life, the errands that must be run, the ball games that must be played, the homework that must be supervised. That's the work that keeps you exhausted when you want to rest, but it is also the work that keeps you in the mainstream of your life. Soon after the holidays, I started chemotherapy. I remembered that in younger days, I had thought, upon seeing melodramatic films with heroines facing cancer, I would forego that difficult treatment and just die. When faced with both alternatives, it was much easier to face the prospect of bloating, nausea, and lost hair rather than an early death. Those dramas usually had the heroine jetting off to the Paris she always wanted to see, or embarking on a journey to check off humanitarian deeds she must do before she dies. The reality, I learned, is that you have to buckle down, reserve your energy, and not take chances with injury before you begin treatment. And you have to save your money. Disease does not provide such a glamorous or easy escape. I'd read brochures about general chemotherapies, the importance of taking in more than the normal count of calories to avoid weight loss. So I had permission, I thought, during the holidays to pack it on. It would be just my luck that I would get the wrong signal. My oncologist during our first meeting in January let me know, "You will gain weight, mark my word." Apparently, all that extra calorie talk was intended for patients on other protocols. Upon looking at my now doughy face, I thought, leave it to me. I can't even have cancer and reap the benefit of shedding a few pounds. The nadir of my treatment came in September during the last 2 months of the second protocol of chemo. I found myself giving it over to God when a blood clot had developed near my heart. My best friend DZ, upon hearing the news, immediately made the 4-hour trip to see me. This is a woman who does not believe in lost causes, bad moods, or poor fashion choices. She had heard through family that the toughest and most painful part for me now was that blood had to be drawn from my feet, courtesy of my wimpy arm veins. Not to be daunted by this, DZ burst into the room like an EF4 tornado, wielding a pedicure kit and the most outrageous, screaming red nail lacquer I had ever seen. "If they are going there, we're going to give them a show they won't ever forget," she announced. And we did. We lay in wait for the unveiling several times a day, bit our lips, and turned away giggling as medical techs either attempted to mask their shock or conjured up some compliment for my outrageous toenails. Now, DZ, as a young mom, newly transplanted to country life, once saved her daughter's Easter duck from a rude chicken snake that mistook the pet for dinner. To her daughter's screams of, Get my ducky, Mommy. She distinguished the tail end of the snake from the business end, grabbed hold, unwound serpent from foul, and then chopped the thief to bits. When her loved ones are challenged, DZ stares squarely into beady, threatening eyes and says, "I double dog dare ya." And so she did when cancer visited her best friend's door, armed with both red nail lacquer and laughter, she painted away the pain. And on that fall day, I realized my best Christmas gift had just arrived, albeit a few months late. Family who would slide through icy mountains to see me, and a friend who would make me laugh and stand by me while shamelessly labeling the cancer journey walking abreast with me. On that day, in my mind, a new Christmas song began to play. Jingle bells, red toenails, laughing all the way.
Sandra Spotts Hamilton, a writer and designer, is a graduate of the University of Arkansas who lives in Little Rock with her husband, Chuck. She is celebrating her 29th year as a cancer survivor and her 40th year of laughter and friendship with DZ Reith. Next, Mary Elaine Lester tries to get in the Christmas spirit and prays for a miracle in The Midnight Christmas Musical Miracle.
It was 2 weeks before Christmas. I was sitting in my car in the mall parking lot. Was my car really a spaceship? I certainly felt like an alien watching all the shoppers gearing up for Christmas. This was the worst time of year for me. I follow the faith that was born at Christmas. How could I not like Christmas? Easter was fine. Easter egg hunt, singing, "Up from the grave he arose." I could handle a 1 or 2 day celebration, maybe even three. But every December, I felt like the biggest Scrooge. I wanted the calendar to fast forward from Thanksgiving to December the 26th. Realistically, though, I couldn't sit in my spaceship car forever. I found Wonder Woman, and she found the door handle. It wasn't always like this. When I was growing up, my mother would start decorating for the holidays right after Thanksgiving. She would iron red ribbons saved from year to year to make bows for the holly and the ivy scattered all over the house. Angels appeared on the tops of dressers and shelves, hearkening the special season. Mom even decorated the bathrooms with evergreen soaps and Christmas hand towels. We would go by our Christmas tree and decorate it as a family while carols floated from our Zenith French Provincial stereo and spiced cider simmered on the stove. When I opened the front door after school, the smell of pine greeted me. Neatly wrapped presents would secretly pile up under the tree. Oh, the anticipation, the excitement, and then Christmas morning. Opening all those presents. How could it get any better? And then, as a family of seven, together we feasted on Christmas dinner. The food, the stories, the laughter. I have such wonderful memories. However, as an adult, I tried and tried, but hadn't been able to match the magic of my Christmas past. No wonder I didn't want to open the car door and join the expectant shoppers. I wasn't one of them. Where had the fairy tale gone? I had had all the ingredients. I had a Cinderella wedding to my Prince Charming. We met at film school and married, surely to live happily ever after. He had come from a large family, and his mother had celebrated Christmas just as mine had, with decorations in every corner. It all seemed meant to be. I remember our first Christmas. Our first Christmas on our own, with our first Christmas tree in our first apartment. So small and wonderful and so special. But winters of hardship came, and the marriage didn't survive.
The heartache of what might have been, however, did survive and surfaced every holiday. Even though Christmas wasn't ho, 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 the rest of the year was looking pretty good. I'd gone back to the teaching career I'd always loved, and now my artistic career would become an avocation I would always love. In fact, 10 days after I filed for divorce, I got an opportunity to audition for a speaking part in a John Grisham film, The Rainmaker. I auditioned feeling I had nothing to lose. That go-for-broke, fearless feeling translates well in film. I got the part. Francis Ford Coppola directed me, and my few lines didn't end up on the cutting room floor. Very official-looking residual checks from Paramount, that 90210 zip code, began appearing in my mailbox every 3 months, reminding me, yes, things are looking up. I even started house hunting in the Hillcrest neighborhood where our former apartment was located. My ex-husband had insisted we live in Hillcrest. I grew to love that neighborhood. That was a good thing he left me. Hillcrest has sidewalks and is filled with friendly, artistic people who don't question what kind of yard art neighbors display. I would fit right in. Now, all I had to do was find the house. One Sunday afternoon, after many solo drives up and down the streets of Hillcrest, I saw the house that made my heart sing. The new house was long, not short and squatty like some Hillcrest homes. Sunlight shimmered through the many windows. I could already see my furniture on the gleaming hardwoods. At 8:01 Monday morning, I called the real estate agent. She gave me the news I wanted to hear. Yes, that house is now for sale. The other offer fell through. We just put the sign back in the yard on Friday. This really is going to be my house. Maybe I can dream again. I was surprised, though, how much emotional and physical energy moving into even the perfect house required. Thank goodness for friends, real friends who help move pianos, unpack boxes, and install blinds. Even with help, not all the boxes got unpacked before school started, and the walls were definitely bare. I loved my new house, and it seemed to love me back. That year, I auditioned for A Christmas Carol at the Arkansas Repertory Theater. I was cast as Mrs. Cratchit. Another dream come true. Yet, as I battled Scrooge on the stage, I was still chasing Christmas in my heart. In non-holiday times, I was getting stronger and stronger. Time to put up pictures and make my house a home. When the decorating dam broke, I even got rid of that huge, ugly brown desk that reminded me of my ex-husband. A bad memory exercised. I would keep the good ones. I was marking my new life in my new home when December's shadow caught me off guard and knocked at my door. I was once again facing the heartache of what might have been. And one more time, I would be the only single at the family festivities. Despite having pocketed dreams I never believed possible, the Christmas I so longed for still eluded me. Having survived yet another Christmas season, I continued to search for presents for my new home. Teapots, crystal vases, butterflies, and other beautiful band-aids essential for my healing. Friends affectionately began to call my home the gift shop. I even collected music. I am and always will be a Michael McDonald fan. The silver-haired, smooth voice of so many good times. His concert ticket has a permanent place on my refrigerator door. Yes, I am a collector, not a get-ritterer. If it works, I keep it.
I own a cassette CD player held together with scotch tape that sometimes has a mind of its own. I push a button and music mysteriously comes on in the middle of the night, or I come home to music playing. I push a few more buttons and the music stops. I certainly don't need a more complicated machine. Months seemed to rush by. September melted into fall, and I was facing another holiday season. One more time, just before Christmas, I found myself in the mall parking lot trying to pull myself together before the Grinch kidnapped me again. I reached over, put my hand on the same door handle. I still needed help. I paused, whispering another prayer for a Christmas miracle. I may not be able to recreate. I may not be able to recreate my mother's Christmas, but maybe, just maybe, I could create my own. I opened my eyes, stepped out of the car with newfound courage, and before I knew it, I joined the shopping party. I was one of them. I was buying my Christmas presents with a smile on my face. Now, because I wanted to, not because I had to. I decorated my wonderful home with twinkling lights and all sorts of red and green decorations. I even played Christmas music on the stereo. And for the first time in years, I actually wanted to wait up for Christmas. Just before midnight, I was looking out my frosty window, counting my blessings, and soaking in the holy quiet. Suddenly, Michael McDonald started singing to me from the tape deck I didn't turn on. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. And indeed it was. Then the church bells rang out, and in my heart, I knew I would never be the same. Christmas had come, the one I had known, and I would always be celebrating it.
Mary Elaine Lester, a career mathematics instructor, currently teaches at a distance learning facility reaching rural Arkansas. Mary is a professional actress experienced in theater, film, and commercials. In our final story of the night, come along with Martin Ferguson and his friend as they search for the perfect last-minute gift in The Christmas Present.
It was Christmas Eve, and my friend David and I had just finished watching the annual Christmas parade wind its way down a mostly deserted main street in our small town. David's family happened to be the last Jewish merchants left in town, and specifically downtown, and they sponsored the yearly Christmas parade. As we separated, we moved to our cars. David yelled for me to come over to his truck. Ah, crap, I just realized I forgot to get anything for my folks and sisters for Christmas. We're exchanging gifts in an hour. He said with a touch of desperation dancing through his eyes. I was the calming factor. Well, you're probably out of luck unless you're going to go back in the store and get them something from their own shop. I said with a laugh, the bourbon affecting my sympathy for my dear friend. His desperation now turned to serious thought. There's got to be somewhere open where I can get a few last-minute gifts. I again looked at my friend and I said with a small smirk, I said, this small town, 8 p.m., Christmas Eve. Only two things open now, Quick Mart and the liquor store. David's eyes lit up as he suddenly thought of an avenue to save Christmas. You want to ride with me to the liquor store? He asked in a fast staccato. I slid into the passenger side of his pickup. How could I pass this up? When we think of Christmas in a small town, our thoughts immediately go to sepia-toned visions of a Christmas story or a tale of human redemption like It's a Wonderful Life. The reality is that most Christmases are a mix of a family experience somewhere between the Cratchits and the Griswolds. Christmas in the 80s for me meant going home, eating way too much, and spending time with old friends, drinking in the holidays at my friend's desolate lake house outside of town. My family was never one to have a real Christmas Eve tradition, other than just hanging out at the house and eating 14 varieties of homemade Christmas candy that all contained some variety of pecans, which happened to be free and plentiful behind our house and our neighbors' houses. There were pecan sandies, chocolate fudge with chopped pecans in it along with a whole pecan on top, chocolate haystacks with slivered pecans in it, and of course pralines with pecans. So you get the idea. Anyone with a nut allergy coming to my house better enter in a hazmat suit. Most Christmas Eves found me spending time with my mother and grandmother and then bolting to the lake house where drinking, smoking, and other bad habits were encouraged. I'd agreed earlier to meet David downtown in front of the store to watch the parade and enjoy a little hot toddy. As I pulled into the store parking lot, I could see David and his family through the large holiday decorated storefront having an old Fezziwig moment with their employees as they pulled down the safety shutters and handed them their Christmas bonus checks as they left. David joined me out front and we stood in the not so cold enjoying our warm whiskey. As the float started coming up the street, I thought about the irony of a Christmas parade being sponsored by our local Jewish merchants. It was all part of immersion. That's kind of funny. It was all part of immersion into local society by their ancestors, I was told. The variety of Girl Scout and Lions Club floats were mixed in with the local high school marching band, along with an assortment of farm implements, and finishing up with Santa tossing candy from an antique Corvette owned by a local doctor. The parade lasted a grand total of about 30 minutes, just long enough to finish the thermos of good times and leave the crowd satisfied. Goodbyes were exchanged with David's family and a wishing of Merry Christmonica to all in their house. David told me that he would be meeting his family in about an hour to exchange gifts, long enough to go home and clean up a little, and he would meet me at the lake house later to begin our Christmas Eve ritual. That's when he realized he had forgotten to get them presents. As we worked our way to the southern edge of town towards Rocky's Liquor, he looked at his watch. This is actually going to work. I've got enough time to get bottles of booze for everyone, wrap them up in foil, and I'll be a Christmas hero. Arriving at the store, we find Rocky sitting behind the counter, grumpier than usual because of the Christmas Eve hours he chose to keep, probably to make a few extra dollars to cover the wife's present. David roared into the store, ready to complete his journey. Rocky, you're the man with the plan, and I need help. He barked orders at Rocky, and Rocky looked down his nose at David, surely wanting to bash one of the large magnums of champagne across his head. The checklist had begun like preparing for a launch at Cape Canaveral. For Mom, a good bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon will do. For my sister Ruth, he scanned the store displays sitting in the floor. She loves champagne, so that'll be easy. He picked up a bottle with a red and silver bow around the neck. Matching the family names and their favorite spirits was coming all so easy now for David. Sarah has always liked a good vodka, so a bottle of Grey Goose for her. Vodka made by the French, I thought. What a great combination. You do have gift bags for these, don't you? Quizzed Rocky. Rocky stopped long enough from his crossword to point his chewed up pencil at a post by the cash register that held an array of foil wraps to put on bottles. David had made it all the way down his checklist to his father, and for Dad, his voice trailed off. It had just dawned on David that his father had been battling health issues, mainly a bad heart, and had been told by his doctors no smoking or drinking. A glitch in the plan. I tried to scoot David along, assuring him that Rocky's was not going to be an option for his dad, unless his dad was a big fan of beer nuts or koozies that said, I don't have a drinking problem. I drink, I get drunk, no problem. As he ran through his limited options for the evening and his father's gift, an idea popped into his head. To the Quick Mart. We raced across town to the Quick Mart, hoping they would still be open now at this late hour. The light outside was still glowing on the faded sign as we pulled into the parking lot. The Quick Mart was ill-prepared for the last-minute Christmas shopper for the man of the house. The aisles were not filled with grooming accessories, fine cigars, and club ties, but with meat and cheese stick combos, bait, and cheap chew tobacco. The sense of doom seemed to be settling into the situation until something caught David's eye. It was odd. It was interesting. It was a taxidermy stuffed scene of a squirrel valiantly preparing to do battle with an incoming owl. The owl's wings stretched wide. It made quite a dramatic statement. And then David asked the old man behind the counter, something you don't expect you will ever hear on Christmas Eve. How much for the squirrel fighting the owl? How much for the squirrel fighting the owl? The old man looked confused and finally processed what David was asking. Not for sale. David felt the old man was not taking him seriously. Look, I need a last-minute Christmas present for my dad, and I want to buy that. How much? The old man was a quick study and realized here was a chance to make some easy money. $80, he said in a flat ticket-or-leave-it tone. Done, David shot back, taking me by surprise. It was obvious he was in no mood to quibble and wanted this to be over and done. David started peeling four $20 bills onto the counter and asked the man politely if he could wrap it. I didn't think that was the funny part. The man crawled up and pulled the display down and gave David a stack of penny one ad papers to wipe it up in. As I got out of David's truck back at the shop, he wished me a Merry Christmas and thanked me for coming along on his odd journey. I laughed as I walked away and said with a smile, I wouldn't have missed this for anything.
Martin Ferguson lives in Malmo, Arkansas with his beautiful wife and curious 11-year-old son. He was a member of the 1979 State Junior Bowling Championship team. He is addicted to all things college. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.